That applies to all color in the spirit world, whether it be of the flowers, of the buildings, of the water, or of the clothes we wear. Color with us means light, absence of color means darkness. A great many people on earth have what they call their favorite color. So do we in the spirit world, even among the galaxy to be encountered upon every hand. Some will account for this particular partiality, I am speaking of you now, by averring that the colors themselves call to mind various pleasant circumstances. Folk will say, for instance, that yellow and its different tones pleases them most because yellow is a sunny color and so reminds them of the summertime. Others will prefer green, saying that it conjures up the meadows and fields and shady woods. Bright blue will put other folk in remembrance of the sea and clear skies, while red makes some feel warm and comfortable, and so on. These diversified mental images could be multiplied almost without number. There is also another side to the story, for some people will express great distaste for certain colors because they remind them of unpleasant things. With the latter we are not now concerned. Such association of ideas with colors provides one with a certain basis for the predilection, but the real reason lies much deeper than that. Just as your physical body will give all outward signs that it requires some special but easily acquired element to keep it in good health, so does the higher self require that which is part of its very substance, namely, color. This need becomes translated into a predilection for the color it needs. In speaking of the higher self, I would ask you to remember that every single soul, incarnate and discarnate alike, has the divine element within him. It may be so crushed by a gross nature and gross living as to be almost extinct, but absolutely extinct it can never be. Even in those awful dark regions where everything is of the foulest, the yet resides within every one of those unhappy souls that celestial element, call it the divine spark, if you wish, that can never, in any circumstances, die or be extinguished. It is from that microscopic gleam that progress will commence, though it may take thousands of years of earthly time before it shows the least sign of activity, of increasing. The higher self will be manifest in a variety of ways, including that special taste for a certain color. With you on earth it means that some one color or another is required in your etheric counterpart, which is thus reached through the physical body, and it reveals itself in this way by implanting in you a preference for a specific color, the color which you so favor is completely in tune with you, hence the unmistakable feeling of warmth towards that color. If it should, in the process, call to mind such agreeable things as the sea, or the woods, or sunny days, and so on, then so much the better, for such imaginings will help to strengthen your preference for that color and so lead you to introduce and employ it, or its different shades, whenever it is practicable. By doing so, you will derive excellent benefit both physically and mentally. What is yet more important, your etheric body, for which your physical body is but the visible covering, will also benefit. You will perhaps say that, as things are at present conducted, it is not always easy to incorporate one's favorite color in such measure as is necessary. Men, indeed, with their excessively colorless and drab clothing, and with their customary diffidence of anything that is not strictly in accordance with prescribed ideas, will feel that the color question is an impossible one for them, beyond introducing some little extra color into their homes. That is a situation which, there is every hope, will be fully remedied in the future. It undoubtedly will take some time because of that diffidence to which I have just alluded. But the change to more colorful apparel will become a universal movement in due course. I am not pretending to prophesy, but solely giving you some idea of a general trend which will be noticed, we are persuaded, before too long. From this trend it is possible to perceive, according as I have discussed with you a little earlier in these present writings, what we all hope in the spirit world will eventually come to pass, and that is the better and more adequate introduction of color into your whole life upon earth. It matters not whether it be in your clothing or your building, so long as the color is there. When smoke has been so abated as to vanish altogether from your cities and towns, your buildings will have a better chance of preserving some of their initial cleanliness of surface. You will still have the fumes from vehicular traffic to pollute the air, but that minor problem will also be solved in its proper season. Nothing then stands in the path of making your cities truly beautiful by the wholesale introduction of color, properly applied and properly blended, into all your edifices. You cannot imagine, you will say, what on earth a beautiful Gothic cathedral would look like if it were in color. Hideous, and possibly vulgar, monstrous, you might be tempted to declare. Think of a pink cathedral, or a purple one. Why, the whole idea is ludicrous. Is it really? So, not by any manner of means, my dear friends. The trouble is that such introduction of color would be so very unusual to you because you have grown accustomed to being more or less without it. Now you may say that there are certain parts of the earth world that are far from being devoid of color, that on the contrary, they are so filled with color as to be regarded as a veritable paradise in this respect. That is perfectly true. But even the most delectable regions of your terrestrial globe are dingy compared with the realms of light of the spirit world. The climate, you will affirm, has much to do with it. In these earthly paradises the weather, as a rule, is clement and the sunshine is lavish. That is equally true. But of them we are not talking. The realms of light teem with color. The buildings, whether the great halls and temples or the simple and unobtrusive private dwellings, are constructed of materials in which color is always present. Even the paved ways are in color. The trees, the flowers, the grass, the very soil in which these grow and thrive, the water, whether it be of sea, river or lake, are revelations of color in every shade, blend, and tint. Lastly, ourselves. Our spirit clothes are the very embodiment of color, for I verily believe that the widest variety and distribution of blends are to be perceived in our personal habiliments, reflecting, as they do, all the extremely fine gradations of spiritual progression. In this respect, color might serve the purpose of a recording instrument. You have no scientific instrument on earth that could register results as accurately as color registers the least degree of our spiritual progression, for in this regard color is infallible in what it reveals. There is no such thing as being able to assume a color to which one is not entitled by reason of not having earned it. When you hear wise people on earth tell you that we who communicate are nothing but devils masquerading as angels of light, they are uttering the most blatant nonsense and displaying the most profound ignorance of common, elementary, spiritual laws. Let me say this with emphasis: it is utterly impossible for anyone in the spirit world, no matter who it may be, to assume the tiniest, most minute spark of light to which he is not entitled. Light and color mean spirituality, their absence, the lack of it. There are no exceptions, no deviations. That is a fundamental law operating throughout the entire spirit universe, a law that is fixed and immutable. Color is natural to the realms of light. In the gray lands and the lands of darkness it is absent. With us color is light, and the light is living light. That, I admit, is difficult to follow, but it is capable of a little elucidation. In this way, take for example, your precious stones, and particularly the diamond. Now all precious stones on earth rely for their beauty upon external light. From the purely artistic point of view, all your precious stones become valueless when they are in absolute darkness. They might be composed of some common substance for all the worth they then are, but the instant they are brought into the light, either artificial or that of the sun, their luster becomes immediately apparent. The stones are in that respect dead, they have no life in them, for they contain no luminosity of their own, and are obliged to rely solely upon reflected or transmitted light. We have a myriad forms of precious stones in these lands, and of such transcendental beauty and luster as to surpass, beyond conception, anything that has ever been discovered, fashioned, or created upon earth. Every form of gem in turn has its wide range of colors, from the palest to the deepest. Diamond, emerald, sapphire, ruby, topaz, to name the most familiar to you, are all represented here, but every stone, no matter whether it be as small as the tip of your little finger or larger than your clenched hand, each single stone carries its own perfect light. It gives forth its superb colors unaided, for it needs no external source of illumination, either reflected or transmitted. It is itself alive. It glows and sheds its exquisite rays with incomparable, ineffable splendor. The stones are flawless, every one of them. It is impossible to detect the most microscopic blemish upon any stone. Priceless, you will say. Indeed, they are, for they are not to be bought. They can only be earned. For use as personal adornment, these matchless and priceless jewels are given to us as part of our spiritual rewards. They constitute some of those wonderful adjuncts to our life here that bring joy not only to the possessors of them, but to all who behold them upon others. A little fanciful, you will perhaps hint, or eccentric. Not in the least. Were you able to take one of these gems in your hand, all your mundane ideas upon the subject would vanish upon the instant. Those of my earthly friends whose vision has been cultivated, and who are able to see such things as these, will readily be able to substantiate my words, if so be it they have actually seen jewels of the spirit world. While I am upon the subject, the workmanship in the settings of our jewels is, of course, in perfect keeping with the lustrous stones. They are worn upon the person as part of a headdress, or as fastening upon the girdle, or suspended from a chain round the neck. And so another chapter is added to the volume of color. As it is with our precious stones, so is it with the stones of lesser value, our building materials. The surface of your stone is dull and without color. The purist will say I am wrong, that because the earthly stone can be gray or cream, or even red in tone. Of course, but what of the rest of the colors of the spectrum? Where are those to be found in your stonework? The surface of our stone, and you will understand that I am here using earthly terms to describe spirit world substances. The surface of our stone is an alabaster-like translucence. Upon close examination, it is at once observed that the color and the light which gives it life come from within the substance itself. It literally glows, yet it has not the appearance of being illuminated from within. My present difficulty, you see, is to convey my meaning when I have nothing with which to draw a comparison for you, because there is nothing upon earth akin to our building materials. The best I can do, therefore, is to try to set down what we see when we gaze about us, and to do so in as literal terms as possible. The color of the stone, then, shines forth, but you must not assume from this that our buildings are aglitter with rays of colored light, flashy and flamboyant. The glow that one perceives is a soft, gentle, delicate glow of subdued light, not a sharp, penetrating flood of light. While the colors have the texture of pastel shades as you know them, as the buildings are set amid beautiful gardens with a wealth of flowers and trees and lawns, the color of the edifice must accord with its environment and not, by the power of its vividness, overwhelm the hues of nature itself. I must reaffirm that the shades of color in our buildings are extremely delicate, so that when I tell you that we have such architectural glories as Gothic cathedrals just as on earth, though used for a very different purpose, and that they are built in colored stone, there is no occasion to take alarm when I suggest that you can emulate us in all the new buildings which in time will rise upon earth. The question of purple cathedrals does not arise, nor of a flaming scarlet one either. Once more, I do not pretend to prophesy, but to mark for you a trend which is to be observed in our laboratories here, namely, that in due time a substance will be discovered or evolved, or invented if you wish, that will enable builders on earth to apply a surfacing to their buildings harder and more durable than at present known or used. Into this will be incorporated any coloring matter of whatever shade is desired, from brilliant hard colors to delicate soft tints. Of whatever the building itself may be constructed, this substance will be applied last of all, and give a most beautiful shade and texture to the whole fabric. It will be smooth and easily cleaned, but with the absence of smoke it will hardly become tarnished. That, my friends, is a simple forecast of what you should be able to do on earth if those in authority over you will only bestir themselves, and think sometimes in terms of beauty and not merely of utility. Why should you not have both beauty and utility in all your buildings? That is what we have in these highly serviceable lands of the spirit world. Just bethink you what a difference it would make in the whole appearance of your cities and towns were tasteful harmonious color schemes to be introduced everywhere. In time your own homes will benefit as well, for these new discoveries are meant for all people. I have been permitted to peep into some of the laboratories here from time to time, and that is one item I am allowed to reveal to you. Not a very mighty one, you may say, but nevertheless one that should ultimately help to bring some of that urgently needed color into the unutterable grayness of the earth, or some quarters of it. I freely admit that when I was incarnate the old earth looked a very good place in which to live, and in those days I knew little or nothing, mostly nothing, of what was to follow. I was contented to cling to my life on earth for as long as it was permitted, and to leave it with as good grace as possible. I hope I succeeded in accomplishing the latter. I rather fancy I did, for my friends of those days would say that I had a very good death, meaning, as far as they could see, a truly pious one. We have had much laughter upon this subject since then. However, the earth seemed a pleasant place, and I was not bothered about the colorlessness of it, until I came here. Then I saw just what I had left behind me as I perceived to what I had come. It is as though you were to gaze upon two pictures, the one in plain gray monochrome and the other in full color. Try that simple little experiment for yourself, and then, my friends, you will have some idea, some very small idea, of the difference between the absence of color in your world of the earth and the profusion of color in our world of the spirit. Next headline is Mistaken Views. Views are varied among the incarnate as to the exact spiritual position, or proper designation, of the realms wherein I live. Some will regard them not as heaven itself, but as a kind of annex thereto, an outland of heaven rather than the place of celestial bliss which the majority have in mind. Such a conception arises, one imagines, from the fact that in these lands we have so much, it might be objected, of a very material nature, for what could be more material than houses and buildings generally, and gardens, and rivers and seas, not to mention our multifarious occupations? Such things do not seem concordant with one's idea of heaven. No, they do not, but that is because the common idea of heaven is built altogether upon wrong foundations. The part of the spirit world, therefore, in which I live, would be regarded as not being of the nature of heaven at all. For heaven is unquestionably the abode of angels and saints, and those beings could not, by any freak of the imagination, be the least interested in, or concerned with, such material things as I have recounted to you as the grand features of these particular regions. It is difficult to do other than associate heaven with religion, because the Church has always claimed exclusively to deal with such matters as the soul's salvation, and that closely concerns heaven, that most difficult place to enter. What it really amounts to, then, is that I, with countless others like me, am not in heaven at all, but decidedly outside it. We shall see about that later. There is another view often expressed upon this subject, namely that while we may be immensely happy in these realms, yet we are hardly of a very spiritualized nature. As we go on progressing, we shall leave behind us this material order of life, and become highly etherealized. We shall proceed from realm to realm, ever higher and higher. Just so. Then what happens? According to some of the incarnate, we shall become so spiritually elevated that we shall be forced to stay where we are, for to descend to a lower plane would mean the most exquisite torture to us. The physical aspects of our bodies will similarly undergo a transmogrification until we lose all semblance of our former selves, as our many friends know us, and develop into beings, so it would appear, composed entirely of light, possessing very little real substance, hardly distinguishable from one another either in form or feature, and dispossessed of every human attribute, featureless, humorless and remote. Let me say emphatically that this is not so. Very far from it. Who shall say where heaven begins? He would be a bold one among us here in these lands who would venture upon an answer. What are the facts? I can only give them to you as I find them, and that is as millions of others find them too. If you wish to say that these realms are of material nature, then do so by all means. You will be affirming precisely the same as we do. We are eternally thankful that they are material. Everything is most gloriously solid round about us. Excellent. That is just as we like it. The water is wet and sparklingly clear, the light is bright and beautiful. The clothes we wear feel exquisite to the touch, and the chairs in which we sit are most commodious and comfortable. If we proceed to another realm, we may find the water is thick and dirty, and the light not so bright. That, you will perhaps remark, is understandable. But what if we proceed in another direction? We shall observe that the water is still more sparklingly clear, the seating arrangements are even more commodious and comfortable than our own, and the light a great deal stronger and more beautiful. And so it will be all the way through the realms of light. The highest realms are every atom as material to the residents of those realms as are these realm to us of a lower realm, who are privileged to visit them, as are our own. What of the beings who inhabit those lofty regions? Most certainly they are not mere masses of light and little else. Immense light they assuredly have, but that is part of their nature, not their whole form and substance. There are folk on earth who would declare that it is not possible to gaze upon one of these beings, and survive. That is pure nonsense. We have all of us, at one time and another, gazed upon these personages for a measurable time, and we are still very much surviving. The three of us, Edwin, Ruth, and I have visited a most illustrious being in his own surroundings. We have been shown parts of the realm in which he has his home, and I use the word in its literal sense. We were not obliged to shade our eyes in his presence to prevent any blaze of light from consuming us. We sat in very comfortable chairs in a superb apartment, whence we could look upon magnificent gardens. This great man spoke to us as we, and you would expect any rational being to address us. It was a breathtaking experience, of course, and one moreover, which we have repeated upon numerous other occasions. Again, this same person has visited us in our own realm. He has even called upon us at our home, and seated himself in our chairs, and admired our house and all that it contains. He has graced us by his presence when we have had a social gathering of friends, artists and musicians, and the like. He has spoken to us then as in company, and to us individually upon our various efforts. He has cheered and encouraged us with his words and helped to resolve our difficulties. He has joined with us in these little assemblies without any suggestion, without the slightest hint even, that being in conditions so far removed from his own, he was undergoing a severe trial of spiritual endurance. There is not an individual in these or in any other of the realms of light who does not know him by sight, by voice, by illustrious fame. His visitations through all the realms are high days and festivals with us, as he comes upon his official travels. When he visits us personally, and why should he not if such is his wish? He cannot, of course, remain unnoticed by others, but the private nature of his coming is accorded a ready appreciation. And what he can do, others of less spiritual altitude also are able to do, and they do it. In his transit, this great person has not lost any of the stupendous attributes which are his. He is not so etherealized as to be, to all appearances, a mass of light. He is human in these lower realms even as he is in his own natural environment. We have seen him in both places, and therefore we can speak from first-hand experience. As we progress and advance from realm to realm, we retain our individuality as well as the outward form and features by which we are recognized. The light which bespeaks our spiritual elevation may become more intense, but never so much as to submerge, beneath its power and brilliance, that which is our very personality. Certainly, to a person of low spirituality, the brightness of light would be blinding, but we are not inhabitants of those dark realms, and our eyes are not vexed by such light, but rather should we bask in the rays of spiritual greatness. When we make visits to the higher realms, some adjustment is necessarily made, but the latter is not to prevent us from being consumed or so bedazzled that our wits would desert us under the magnitude of spiritual splendor. Our personal feelings at what we see may be overwhelming, but that is induced by our sense of spiritual inferiority, by the perfection of what are beholding. Our hearts and minds may be full, but we suffer no bodily discomfort. What do we see when we mount to these rarefied realms? According to most religious accounts, one can see nothing but some species of cloudy magnificence, and precious little else. Complete idleness would thus seem to be the order of things, except for an unremitting program of hymn singing, and an eternity of prayer and praise. What it comes to, then, in the minds of some folk, is that the higher one ascends spiritually, the less one does actively, until the moment arrives when one does nothing at all but lift up the voice in song. What becomes of the accumulated knowledge and wisdom for which these high beings are renowned? Surely it is a shameful waste of such superlative attributes merely for the owners of them to devote their whole time to spiritual vocalistic exercises. And what a strange conception of the Father of the universe to suppose that he should require such profitless services rendered to him. That does not bespeak an all-wise being. Logic and sanity revolt at such an outre notion. It is not surprising, for logic and sanity are both right. No, my dear friends, the spirit world is conducted upon far better and more rational lines than that. All our efforts in these lands of light are directed towards a useful purpose. Bear that always in mind. We aim to serve our fellows, whether incarnate or discarnate, as you would call us, usefully, and in serving you, we serve the Father of us all. And he wants us to do useful work, work that will bring some measure of good to some person. That rule, as one might name it, applies to all the realms of the spirit world, even to the highest. You would be astonished at the colossal amount of work that goes on continuously in those high realms. There is no time to spare for the inordinate singing of spiritual canticles, there are far more important things to be done. I know at least one of these high personages to whom singing of this description would be positively unendurable. Not that we do not have the most beautiful voices in these lands, but the hymn, envisaged by so many of the incarnate, does not belong to the highest form of the musical art. Nor must it be thought that spiritual elevation brings with it, ipso facto, a superb singing voice. The human voice can be very lovely, and, musically speaking, is really the most wonderful of all instruments, but fortunately for us all, we know how to use it in these lands, and when not to use it. Unfortunately for you, you have not as yet heard how truly beautiful good singing can be. Unless your psychic talents have been cultivated, you are not likely to, until you come here to reside. So, as we progress into those high realms, we shall not lose our individuality in supposed etheric clouds, and become lost to everyone except the dwellers therein. We shall ever continue to be ourselves, our true selves, refined, to be sure, more etherealized, but still you will be you, and I shall be I, and no one else. You and I will recognize each other, just as you will recognize all your friends, as they will recognize you. In the immense future that lies before us, we shall not become lost to the companions who are the joy of our lives. Some may advance along the road of progression a trifle faster than others, but we shall always be able to meet as of old. Our wisdom and knowledge will also increase. There will ever be a thousand good purposes to which to devote them. The highest realms of the spirit world are no abodes of idleness, on the contrary, they are brimful of useful activity. What becomes of our sense of humor when we pass into the spirit world is a question that will have occurred to many. It would seem that throughout the numerous communications that have come from us there has so far been no evidence of any humor at all. What is the reason for that? Do you suppose? Let me hasten to affirm that whatever sense of humor we may have possessed on earth is fully retained when we pass into the spirit world.